ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National.
They get out the tear gas. They ask the director of the correctional centre, should I just spray everywhere? And it is noted in the court case that he says, I don't care how much gas you use.
Over a decade ago, a group of Aboriginal boys at the Dondale Youth Detention Centre in Darwin were injured in a security response to a disturbance. Should the Northern Territory government be held liable for what happened to them? And should extra damages be imposed on authorities to discourage similar responses in the future?
Exemplary damages is mainly there to punish the state, to deter them from behaviour that has caused such huge hurt or damage to the people involved.
The High Court ruled yes. We'll hear more about that decision a little later on. On the same day, Australia's top court also handed down a decision that clarifies when a protester injured by police at a demonstration is or isn't entitled to compensation. The court ruled that New South Wales police are not responsible for the injury sustained by Laura Cullen while attending an Invasion Day rally in Sydney on Australia Day 2017. Sydney lawyer Mary Maloney acted for the plaintiff. Mary, what injuries did Laura sustain and what impact did this have on her life?
Laura sustained a brain injury, so she was knocked unconscious at the time. So the impact on that was she did ultimately get back to work, but it affected her character in a sense that people with a brain injury often become quite concrete in their thinking. They can overreact, and she was doing that particularly in the workplace, which we would say would interfere with her ability to get promoted into higher positions.
And I think there was an acceptance by both sides that if liability was established, she'd be entitled to something like $800,000 in damages.
That's correct.
And has she made a full recovery or does she live with this brain injury on an ongoing basis?
She's made a good recovery, I would say, but not a full recovery.
So what was the chain of events that led to the injuries that Laura sustained?
So Laura attended the Australian Day Invasion Day rally, which is held every year. It was her first time attending the rally. She went along to see what it was about. And at one stage during the rally came to a stop at the intersection of Broadway and Buckland Street. And there was a gentleman who was a participant in the rally who started speaking quite emotively about the situation with the Aboriginal people in Australia, and also then indicated that he was going to light the Australian flag. Now, it's not illegal to light the Australian flag.
Set it on fire, yep.
Exactly. You know, there was a crowd around him. Laura was part of that crowd, but she was back towards the edge of the crowd.
Can you describe the crowd for me?
The crowd was a mixture of young and old, the elderly, you had children walking with their parents, your children in prams, etc. So it was a real mixture.
And this was a crowd of about 5,000, right?
It was, but in that immediate area, there wouldn't have been 5,000 that were strung along Broadway down George Street, but it was overall a crowd of about 5,000. And as he went to light the flag or bent over potentially to light it, the officers came rushing in. So they were coming from behind the protesters. And this led to just confusion and panic among the protesters.
And as I understand it, the police started using fire extinguishers even before the fire was lit, and people became kind of confused and some angry.
Well, definitely confused and panicky. That's right. There was at least one fire extinguisher, possibly two. And sort of on the towards the outer edge of this particular group, I suppose, there was a police officer, Constable Lowe, recording the events, and another participant Mix Williams came by and slapped the recorder out of her hand. And it was in the course of his arrest, in the immediate aftermath of that, that our client got knocked over and hit her head on the pavement.
So in the scuffle between Max Williams and the arresting officer, they fell onto your client and caused her to then fall and have her injury?
That's correct, yeah. So all three fell and she hit her head in the fall.
So the interaction or the scuffle was between Max Williams and another police officer, Livermore, who then attempted to arrest Mr. Williams, who had struck the police officer with the recording equipment. And in the ensuing struggle, the pair collided with Laura and she fell over and this led to her injuries.
Yeah. And so Laura was standing nearby where that arrest took place. She wasn't in any way involved in that. She was just standing there.
And what was the distance between the man who had lit, was about or saying he was about to light the fire, that was the demonstrator, Mr. Dunn Velasco,
mm-hmm.
and the fire extinguishers and the kind of the melee and the confusion around that, and the officer, Constable Lowe, video recording, there was a bit of a distance, wasn't there?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that for reasons, you know, that going to the scope of liability, but the finding was about 10 to 15 metres in distance.
So Laura sued the police in negligence. She was successful before the trial judge, who awarded her $800,000 in damages. Very, very briefly, what was the reasoning of the trial judge?
Well, he found the actions both of the police and of Sergeant Livermore negligent, and he found that the officers in running into the crowd in the manner they did and spraying the fire extinguishers was an unreasonable response to the risk.
So it was out of proportion to the proposed
exactly.
threat to public safety of lighting a flag. Using, you know, I mean, presumably you have to use some kind of fuel igniter, don't you, to light a flag. You have to kind of put petrol or something like that on the flag.
He did have an accelerant, but it was just a very small container of accelerant, you know, it fitted within his pocket. So yes, he did squirt that on the flag.
Mary, how big was the flag that might have been burnt?
The finding was that it was the size of a pillowcase, or no bigger than a pillowcase.
And was this on bitumen? Was it close to kind of large trees? Were there people very in close proximity to all of this?
So the flag was placed on bitumen. There was no vegetation in close vicinity. And the people formed a semicircle around where the flag was on the bitumen, but they were about a metre back from the flag.
So the initial judge found that the police response to the possible lighting of a flag was out of proportion to any threat to public safety. And what the police did was likely to set off panic and confusion. And that response set off a domino effect that led to Laura's injuries. But this was overturned by the Court of Appeal. Why?
In the Court of Appeal, there were a few reasons, but they found that the actions of the police was not disproportionate. But they also looked at the scope of liability that should be imposed. And they said that what happened to Laura wasn't in the proximate vicinity. So that was one of the issues. Another issue was that the actions of Mix Williams, the person who had slapped the camera out of the police officer's hands, that was a independent criminal action. So that broke the chain of causation. So you couldn't impose a duty on the police because of that independent action. So the Court of Appeal found that 2-1.
So this all went all the way to the High Court, which decided that the police were not liable. It upheld the decision of the Court of Appeal. What was the reasoning of the High Court?
Well, we lost on breach that they found that the actions of the police were reasonable. They looked at the alternative actions the police could have taken or that were put forward that were available to the police. But they found that, you know, in terms of the risk, that the actions of the police were proportional to the risk. Because in their view, the risk here was that the fire could potentially have injured other bystanders, it could have spread, so that the police in rushing in the manner they did was a proportional and reasonable response.
You suggested that there were alternative strategies that the police should have deployed. What were those strategies, and why did the High Court reject those ideas?
One of the propositions put forward was that they could have, I suppose, waited and watched and did nothing, because this is not the first occasion where there's been, attempts to burn the flag at this rally. At an occasion a few years ago, it had a completely different outcome, a few years before Laura's event. So that was one of the actions. Or alternatively, to announce their arrival. Because in this situation, if you look at the witnesses' evidence, they were totally confused because the police came from behind them. And there was discussion about there was a smell of chemical, it looked like smoke in the air, so they didn't really know what was going on. So we had said that if they had come in quietly, announced their arrival, etc., that there wouldn't have been this panic. And you wouldn't have had that chain reaction caused by the panic and the ultimate injury to Laura.
But the High Court rejected that, didn't it? It said, look, that doesn't take into account the dynamic nature of the situation that presented itself. And a reasonable person would not have taken a less forceful response, which was suggested by you and indeed accepted by the primary judge in the trial.
And I guess also accepted by the dissent in judgment in the Court of Appeal as well.
So ultimately, your client has been unsuccessful. How does she reflect on this court process and the High Court's decision?
I think she's still processing it, but I suppose we had always been fully frank with her that there's no certainty in this type of case. There's never any certainty when you're in litigation. So while, of course, it's very disappointing for her, it hasn't come as a total shock, shall I put it like that.
Mary Maloney, Principal Lawyer with MTM Legal in Sydney. Thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National and, of course, available as a podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. The same day as the High Court handed down the Laura Cullen decision, it also handed down another personal injury case. Austral and the Northern Territory focused on what damages should be paid to four detainees in a Darwin youth detention centre who were tear-gassed by authorities. Samantha Lee is an expert in police accountability law. She's the senior lawyer at the Redfern Community Legal Centre in Sydney, and she followed the case closely. Sam, what happened back in 2014?
Yes, this is a mammoth effort case, Damien. Back in August 21st, 2014, at the Don Dale Detention Centre, which is based in Darwin, there was a disruption within the detention centre. It involved five First Nations boys between the ages of 15 and 17. They were in what's called a behavioural management unit, which is a bit secluded from other parts of the detention centre. There were different cells adjoining to what's called an enclosed exercise yard. So it wasn't an outside yard, it was like a room yard. One cell was vacant. There were two boys, Webster and O'Shea, occupied the second cell, and Binsarius and Austral occupied the fourth cell. There was a young boy called Jack Roper who occupied the third cell. Now, Jack and Binsaris and Austral used toilet paper to stop the usage of the cameras in the cell, and they were kicking the cell doors, yelling and breaking lights. And Jack ended up smashing a hole in the metal mesh of the cell door and managed to actually open the door and get into the enclosed yard area. It was escalating, I guess, over time, and there was damage to property and broken windows. And the other boys, though, stayed within their cell, although damaging some property. Two other boys, Webster and O'Shea, they were actually playing cards in their cell while all this disruption was happening. There were several attempts, Damien, by the people within the detention centre to try and de-escalate, I guess, in a sense, what was going on, with little success.
So after a few hours, what happened then?
Yeah, so after a few hours and there was nothing improving, a very key call is made to the director of the Correctional Services, Ken Middlebrook, who calls the acting general director of Berrima Correctional Centre, which is an adult prison. Now, this is quite important in terms of how the matter is played out in the court. So we have a juvenile detention centre who then calls on some support from an adult prison. And what that support meant was this action team, which was mobilised, and that constituted members of the adult prison to come to Dondale Detention Centre to try and de-escalate or to reprimand Jack. And they brought with them three prison officers from the adult correctional centre. They were equipped with masks and protective vests, shields, batons, and some tear gas called CS tear gas. Now, eventually they come to the detention centre and they think of bringing dogs into the yard to try and round up Jack, but they can't get through the door into the yard because Jack had broken the lock on the door. So what they eventually decide to do is to bring out some tear gas. And so they spray this tear gas from the outside of the yard, obviously, because they can't get in. A warning is given before they spray the tear gas to Jack to de-escalate and allow them to restrain him, but he does not comply.
So they throw the tear gas into that kind of central kind of area where Jack is out of his cell and in that indoor exercise area. And behind that are the cells where the other four kids are still sitting, and those cells have no windows, no running water and no air conditioning. What happens next?
So that's really important to note. So these other young boys are what we probably see later in the court, just collateral damage to trying to restrain Jack. So they, as you say, are in these cells. There's no windows, there's no aircon. Actually, in this area, Damon, there's no running water. So eventually they get out the tear gas. They ask the director of the correctional centre, how much should I just spray everywhere? And it is noted in the court case that he says, I don't care how much gas you use. And what they do is they proceed to then spray the tear gas. What they don't know, which comes out in the court case, is that the couple of the boys also have asthma, and obviously any tear gas could be even fatal for those type of boys with breathing problems. Tear gas is a weapon used, I guess, by police in certain situations, probably more associated with police using them in protest situations. They cause like feeling of suffocation, extreme burning of the eyes, breathing difficulties. In some situations, it does cause 60 seconds of around total incapacitation. It can, in some situations, cause injury and sometimes death if there are large concentrations of this gas. Anyway, this gas is propelled into the exercise yard. There's two squirts of the gas. Jack is still not detained. They then go on to extenuate six more bursts of this gas. Eventually, Jack does fall to the ground and they go in to restrain them. In that time, while they're restraining Jack, the other boys are left in the cells and the gas obviously has gone into those areas as well.
And some of these boys experienced intense irritation to the eyes and nose and throat and breathing difficulties. Two of the children had asthma and one thought he was going to die. What happened next?
It is not until Jack is restrained that they then go into the cells and handcuff the other boys, handcuff them to their arms at the back, and then take them down to the basketball courts where they place them face down on their stomachs, still their arms handcuffed behind their backs, and proceed to hose them down to try and get off some of the tear gas.
So ultimately, what did the High Court award? I think there were two boys got $100,000, one boy got $90,000, one boy got $70,000, and some of this was general damages, the damages for compensation. Some of it was aggravated damages for the injured party, the emotional distress and the humiliation that they experienced, but also that $50,000 each in exemplary damages to punish the defendant. What is that idea of exemplary damages, and what was at the heart of the High Court case in awarding that?
Yeah, so exemplary damages, Damien, is mainly there to punish the state, to deter them from behaviour that has caused such huge hurt or damage to the people involved in the situation. It is about trying to prevent action from continuing and, as I said, punish the state for what has occurred. And in this case, what the court found is that the persons who undertake the action don't have to consciously know that what they were doing is wrong. The fact that what they did is wrong is enough for the state to be having to pay exemplary damages. Another important aspect of this case is that the court can find that some exemplary damages are manifestly excessive. That is way beyond what the court has awarded in the past. And that's what the court found in this case, is that the original awarding of exemplary damages was too high in comparison to other cases. So they lowered that awarding of exemplary damages.
So the High Court lowered the exemplary damages. The trial judge awarded each of the four plaintiffs $200,000 each in exemplary damages. The Northern Territory Court of Appeal reduced that to nothing, but the High Court has said, yes, the young men are entitled to exemplary damages, $50,000 each. And this is significant because the Northern Territory government argued that they should not be awarded any exemplary damages. They're not relevant in this case.
That's right. So they did find in favour of the appellant that they can award exemplary damages, not just because the prison officers acted unlawfully and that the amount awarded could be lowered.
Another case involving legal liabilities of authorities has just come back before the courts. It's a personal injury class action against New South Wales Police for strip searches at a music festival. So Sam, you are the police accountability lead with the Redfern Legal Centre, and this is your litigation. Who are the members of the class action? Who's the lead member? And where is this case at now?
Yeah, this is a joint class action between Redfern Legal Centre and Slater and Gordon, and it involves the lead plaintiff of Raya Meredith. Now, she went along to a Splendour in the Grass music festival some years ago, and she was taken from a drug dog indication to a tent at the music festival and proceeded to be subject to a full body strip search. There's some egregious parts related to this search in particular. She was postpartum at the time because she just had a baby and was still bleeding in regards to that. That's significant because while she was asked to undress, they had also asked her to remove a tampon that she was wearing at the time. While she was taking off her clothes and bending over, a male police officer, which is against the legislation, came into the area where she was being strip searched and handed back her bag. There are several issues which make this strip search egregious. That was actually one of them. But the continuation of the bad systemic behaviour, traumatic action that caused Raya to feel immense humiliation is a big part of this strip search class action.
So the judge awarded your client $93,000 in damages for compensatory and aggravated damages, but the idea of exemplary damages, which she was, the judge found, entitled to, had not yet been set. So that was going to be a big issue into the future.
That's right. Well, she did find, as you said, that exemplary damages should be awarded in this case because of the state needed to be punished for its wrongdoing. But she wanted to wait for the other class members' cases to be sorted out before setting that amount. But she did flag that she was looking at $50,000 for exemplary damages.
And if you multiply that by 3,000, that would have been pretty significant.
Exactly.
So I think in 2025, there was a finding in favour of your client and the broader class action. But that has just come back before the courts. And the argument of the New South Wales government is again about this idea of exemplary damages.
It is. I need to point out, though, Damien, that the substantive part of the judgment still stands. The appeal is very narrow. It is looking at exemplary damages and aggravated damages. It's making a very similar argument to the Binsaris case, that the police officers were not aware that what they were doing was wrong. They were of the view that they were following the law. And so the state has argued that the exemplary damages should not be awarded in that respect. There are lots of other arguments being made, but that's a major one. And what our side is saying is, no, that's not correct. Just because an individual officer is not aware of their conscious wrongdoing, that does not mean there should be not compensation for exemplary damages.
Why not? Explain a bit more for me, because, I mean, the individual police officers are saying, right, well, there's a public policy about harm minimisation by searching people to prevent people from having, you know, bad drug episodes at music festivals. That's the policy standpoint. What are you saying? And what did Justice Yahia find late last year and the government is now seeking to overturn?
We argue that Justice Yahia actually did find anyway that the police officers did not turn their mind to the legal thresholds, and therefore the argument of conscious wrongdoing, although significant, doesn't always impact on exemplary damages by itself. What the court looked at is also the systemic failings of the state to train its officers to ensure that the law was known throughout the are those who were undertaking the strip searches at the music festivals. There was a systemic failing, she found, by the state in failing to ensure that their police officers knew the law.
So they didn't follow the processes, their own processes?
That's right. The law, although does need some tidying up, it's pretty clear in terms of legal safeguards in regards to strip searches. And what she found is that the police officers did not turn their mind to those legal safeguards and just really ignored them.
Okay, so recently this case has been back in the New South Wales Court of Appeal. New South Wales government is seeking leave to appeal that earlier decision we've just been talking about of Justice Yahia. What are the next steps?
The next steps is to wait for the judgment to be handed down by the Court of Appeal. As I said, the arguments are very narrow around damages and also whether force can be used to make someone conduct a strip search. And once we hear back from that, we'll be able to see what aspects of the judgment are there, whether they remain on foot or whether there will be some changes in regards to what can occur in terms of a strip search. The other part, though, to the strip search class action is the continuation of the other class members and working out how much the class members should receive in terms of damages. So one part of the class action is going along a different road, and that is a road of determining the level of damages for different categories of strip searches that occurred.
So there are like 6,000 class members. They each have different experiences. And what you're having, I understand, 12 sample cases are being heard to determine the damages of each particular kind of general category of person and their experience.
Yes, there's 3,000 registered class members, but we think there's around 3,000 more class members that could be included. And yes, they're trying to work out through these sample cases the different categories of damages and the level of damage that should be awarded. So we have a very egregious case in terms of the lead plaintiff to less egregious cases that would be awarded less than the main plaintiff.
Sam Lee, expert in police accountability law and senior lawyer with the Redfern Community Legal Centre in Sydney. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you, Damien.
That's all we've got time for. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thank you to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.